Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On March 11th, 2020, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the World Health Organization's Director General, sat down in Geneva and made a sober announcement.
We're deeply concerned both by the alarming levels of spread and severity and by the alarming levels of inaction. We have therefore made the assessment that COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic.
I remember that moment. And I will be completely honest. I also remember not really comprehending the seriousness of what Dr. Ghebreyesus was saying and not feeling all that concerned about it. It's truly terrible to say now because on March 11th, 2020, there were already more than 100,000 COVID cases around the world. China and Italy were locked down. New York State had declared a disaster emergency, and we had already even done a bunch of shows on COVID on this program. And yes, I also happen to have a master's degree from the Harvard School of Public Health, so I am actually ashamed to say this, but I've also got to face facts. Because when Dr. Ghebreyesus talked about a global COVID pandemic on March 11th, 2020, my mind actually went back to SARS. In the early 2000s, SARS had been Asia's challenge, I recalled. So I thought COVID was going to be an Asia and Europe problem, really. I made a lot of presumptions from the comfort of my life in my corner of the world, including relying on the fact that the United States had public health experts who were the envy of the world. So I stopped paying attention to Dr. Ghebreyesus's speech after he gave that, you know, we call it the money quote, that quote about declaring a global pandemic. But looking back, I should have listened intently all the way through to what he said at the end.
There has been so much attention on one word. Let me give you some other words that matter much more. These are prevention, preparedness, public health, political leadership, and most of all, people. We're in this together to do the right things with calm and protect the citizens of the world.
The WHO's Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus on March 11th, 2020. Like I said, I should have listened. We all should have listened. Dr. George Diaz thinks about that too. He's a doctor in Washington State who was on the team that treated the U.S.'s first ever COVID patient.
Now to developing news, a case of coronavirus has traveled from China to Western Washington. Good evening, I'm Dave Wagner.
I'm Monique Minglaufen. Now that virus has killed 9 people and sickened over 400 in China. Health officials say the man traveled from Wuhan, China to SeaTac Airport last week on his way back to Snohomish County.
Early on in the pandemic, there was a lot of support from the general public towards healthcare workers. And I think that healthcare workers were proud to be on the front lines of this disease. Over time, unfortunately, I think within our society in the U.S., there have been clear disalignment between different portions of our society, even with things that we know are helpful, like vaccines and masks. Those differences in our society has made the job of the healthcare worker much more stressful and led to much more burnout. I saw how my hospital dealt with the county health department, our state department of health, and the CDC, and I could see how our local governor, the state of Washington, all worked together towards a common goal, but it just broke down, and that's led to needless death and suffering. That, I think, for me has been the most unexpected thing about this. I thought that as Americans, we could unify behind, you know, a common goal and address a serious problem. And it turned out we really couldn't.
Dr. George Diaz, Division Chief of Medicine at Providence Regional Medical Center Everett in Washington State. Now, you know, if you've been a regular listener to this show, over the past 2 years, we've kept saying over and over and over again, the pandemic is a mirror. It's a mirror being held up to the world, to this nation, and there's a lot that has been reflected back. So honestly, we could do 100 straight shows about lessons learned from the pandemic. But today, we're going to at least focus on 4 of those lessons, as illuminated by Richard Toefel. He's founding general manager and former president of ProPublica. He's a distinguished visiting fellow at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And he recently wrote an article in The Atlantic titled, How is America Still This Bad at Talking About the Pandemic? Richard Toefel, welcome to you.
Meghna, thanks so much for having me.
And also with us today is Jack Beattie, On Point's news analyst. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna. Hello, Richard.
Jack, actually, can I just start with you before we dig deeply into Richard's sort of 4 lessons learned here? Just briefly looking back on the past 2 years, where does your mind settle? Where does your heart settle about all that we've been through?
Well, looking back, I came across this this report, the Global Health Security Index for 2019. So, just before the pandemic hit, a survey of 195 countries, it ranked the United States first in its capacity, quote, to prevent, detect, and respond to disease outbreaks. Well, that sounded really promising. And I remember when the reports, you mentioned the pandemic report, I think my reaction was I remembered this study saying, well, we're number one, we're going to handle this. What went wrong? Well, it seems that the report was looking at America on paper. America, the real America, wasn't ready at all. And a major problem, as research has brought out, was the pervasive inequality in life chances and in access to health care that has that was part of the mirror we saw immediately in the pandemic. A country where 35% of adults have no primary care provider, where fear of medical bankruptcy keeps people from even going to the hospital. Another study found that the carceral state, the fact that we lead the world in imprisonment, has a crucial effect on the spread of disease because the prisoners and the 400,000 guards go home every night and they carry with them infection, or they can. The same with nursing homes. Another study looked at the million people who work in nursing homes who carry which are substandard, don't get enough monitoring, and the million people who work there go home and go back to the nursing home and spread things around. And the result was that, you know, at the end of all this, this great system that we were supposed to have built, we now rank 58th. Yeah. In the number of countries that are fully vaccinated, behind Cuba, behind Ecuador. This is a failure of public health communication at one level, but of a society level failure at the other. We weren't the country that the World Global Health Security Index thought we were. Mm. We were someplace else.
Mm. Dick Toefel, respond to that.
Yeah, it's all true. I'm not 100% sure the dots connect quite the way Jack would have them connect. You know, for instance, the way we've fallen short on vaccines is, I think if you look closely at the data, much more linked to politics than it is to inequality. It's not that inequality isn't a serious problem with all of the results that Jack talked about and many more, but the falling short on vaccination, which has been the principal failure, although there were many along the way, the best numbers that I've seen suggest that there are probably about 300,000 people who died in this country because they did not take a vaccine that was readily available to them for free. And I don't think that's mostly an inequality problem. I think, unfortunately, it's in significant measure a political problem.
Yeah. Well, so let me just jump off on that, Dick Toffel, because that then leads directly to the genesis of this article that you had in The Atlantic about, you know, how are we still so bad at talking about the pandemic? We're going to get into the four lessons learned, I promise you, in due time here in the show. But can you tell me a little bit about how about what led to this small faculty seminar that you were leading and running at the Chan School of Public Health at Harvard over the past year? And what was the intent of it in the seminar?
So the intent was it grew out of a conversation or a series of conversations I had with Dean Michelle Williams of the school and her, some of her senior staff last spring. And we thought that we were sufficiently far along that it might be possible to begin to look back, even from the middle of it, at some of the things that had gone wrong in the intersection between the pandemic, the press, and public policy. And so that's what we have tried to do in a group, in an off the series of off-the-record sessions with about 15 or 20 leading members of the faculty of the school and a few people from around Harvard from other schools with particular knowledge about the press. And we've had guests in each month to try to hash through various aspects of it and try to think about, from a particularly a communications and press perspective, how did we come out to such an unsatisfactory place?
Right, because I would say that the combination of bad information and bad politics is what exacerbated violently the pandemic here in the United States. So when we come back, Jack and Richard Toffel and I are going to talk about Richard's four lessons learned about why we're still so bad at talking about the pandemic and hopefully how we can improve when the next one, and there will be another one, comes along. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about at least four lessons learned when it comes to politics and communication. In the midst of a global pandemic, I'm joined by Richard Toffel. He's founding general manager and former president of ProPublica, and he recently wrote in The Atlantic an article titled, How is America Still This Bad at Talking About the Pandemic? Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst, is also with us, and we had asked you, listeners, to just send us your reflections on the past 2 years. And here's On Point listener Lionel Mares from Sun Valley, California, who cared for his mother for much of his adult life. She had chronic kidney disease, and on April 2020, she died from COVID.
Over the years, while attending graduate school, undergraduate school, working full time, it really took a toll on me. But I did it for my mother, and I really miss her. And I feel lonely without her, and her voice, her smile, her laughter. I just finally graduated from graduate school last year, August 2021. And I did it for my mother, you know. I was about to give up, but something in me told me, don't give up, don't give up. Do it for your mom. And I hope she has a happy internal life.
It's Lionel from Sun Valley, California. And we'll hear more listener reflections over the course of the hour. Now, Dick Toefel, in your article, you have four lessons for all of us, but primarily in politics and the media, about how to talk about a pandemic. And they are: the conventional wisdom about avoiding ambiguity and uncertainty is wrong. In a pervasive crisis, science must adjust to politics. Speak the same language the public does, and never forget the heroes. So I actually would like to start with number two, because I found it to be the most counterintuitive. In a pervasive crisis, science must adjust to politics. What do you mean by that?
Well, so, and I think we've started to grapple with this most significantly this year, which is to say, when something has this dramatic effect on society, yes, of course, there are things you should do and shouldn't do, and you sort through them as quickly as you can from a strict public health perspective. But then you have to weigh those considerations against others, against questions of economics, against questions of national security, against questions of morale. So you end up with a debate that I think is only beginning and will go on for years, for instance, about, did we handle schooling, particularly for elementary school students, correctly? Was that the wise approach? Did we appropriately consider the costs of what we were doing? Did we consider alternatives and the costs and benefits that they might entail? And that is not ultimately a science question. Science can inform it. Science can explain to you, here are the risks you are running. Here's how you can relatively easily mitigate those risks, but here are ways you can't. You know, from a strict public health perspective, if you were considering only that, you could lock down the country fairly frequently and seriously, and assuming everyone would go along, you know, that produces one outcome. But then even from a public health perspective, you have psychological issues, but you also, as I say, have economic issues and national security issues, and what do you do about the long-term learning deficit? So all of that wraps in, and I think this was obscured in 2020 because we had a political leadership that was, frankly, particularly weak, which I think is actually sort of the least interesting lesson of the pandemic. You know, try not to have someone in charge who doesn't pay any attention to science or tells people to take horse medicine. So check. Understood. That would be a good idea to skip.
Dick, I'm just going to jump in here for a second here.
Sure.
Much to respond to, and I want to give Jack some space here too. But respectfully, I take a little bit of an exception when you say that we had weak political leadership and that was the least interesting lesson to be learned, because you just said that, and I'll just read from your Atlantic article here, that under any leadership, there comes a time that what may be narrowly in the interest of optimal medical outcomes must be weighed against the impacts on the economy, equity, education, et cetera. Okay, but then the person doing the weighing or the people doing the weighing, if it's weak leadership, I mean, I think that's exactly the biggest lesson that 2020 gives us, that it's hard to have faith in leadership that's making decisions that, I mean, people were saying it was causing the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Americans, Dick.
So can I just clarify?
Sure, sure.
I didn't say it was the least important. I said it was the least interesting.
Okay.
Right. It is actually probably, I agree with you, the most important. But it's like, you know, for instance, somebody who will recommend that people drink bleach or take horse medicine, yeah, we shouldn't have a president who does that the next time. We're very unlikely to have a president who does that the next time. We've probably in 44 presidents, this was the first and last one who would have done that. So much more interesting, I think, is how you weigh the hard questions.
Okay. Jack, I don't share Dick Toefel's confidence, to be honest, that that 2020 is the first and last time that that Donald Trump specifically may be in the White House. But go ahead, Jack.
Well, Richard, what about this? I remember finding cogent the argument that public health had to come first because, well, people wouldn't go to restaurants if infection was, if the disease was rife. People wouldn't go to theaters. People wouldn't. So you really almost had to recognize that that the economic question was subordinate to the pandemic, and therefore fighting the pandemic overall and was the best and primary strategy, even if it meant suspending just for the you know, the period of activity of public health measures, the economic factor. Why is that wrong? Why is that that focus a wrong one?
I think in the spring of 2020, it's probably exactly the right one. Mm. But as you go along, as you learn more, the balance maybe shifts a little. And are there some things that should have been resumed sooner, that should have been relaxed sooner, that where considerations should have started to weigh differently? As I say, I think the hardest question, and the one we'll be wrestling with for a very long time, is whether we handled the school year of 2021 as well as we should have.
Yeah. So actually, on that point, Dick, let me just flip this a little bit, because total transparency, we will refocus for a moment on the Trump administration. But I think you're exactly right about raising the schools question, because your overall point here is science must adjust to politics. But the schools question is also one in which politics was actually running the show for a long time. And in this case, it was largely blue states, right? Or a state or even counties or districts that tended to lean blue that were closed for a much longer period of time. So the idea that that politics a la conservative or Republican politics is the problem, I think the pandemic blew that open too. What do you think about that?
Well, I think there's some truth to that. I also think that some of those blue states may have taken too narrow a perspective of what their obligations of public leadership were. You know, the scientific answer is the beginning. I agree with Jack completely. It is the beginning of the answer. It is not the end of the answer.
Yes. I and science would actually even also say that it's never going to be even the beginning of the answer, right? It's just providing data and guidance. But I'm trying to suss out here, and maybe just help me by reflecting on what the doctors and physicians and public health experts in your seminars said, because the idea that science must adjust to politics is true, right? Because people have to make decisions, and those decisions are being made by political leaders, not scientists. But I just kept hearing all over the place people saying, well, follow the science. And that had actually turned into a political mantra. So, Dick, what do you think about that?
I think at the beginning it was a very important caution because, again, we had leadership that didn't really want to follow the science. Mm-hmm. I think follow the science as a mantra, the problem is it suggests it gets you all the final answers. And it doesn't. And you can argue about whether this was a terrible thing or is a terrible thing. We lived as a society before March of 2020 with roughly 100,000 deaths a year from the flu.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very important thing to remember.
Yeah.
Now, maybe you think that was an immoral judgment and maybe you think our society should have been adjusted, and you're entitled to that point of view. But that is a very important baseline that I think we can't miss.
Mm. You know, Jack, I just want to point out the obvious that, you know, we are having this conversation in March of 2022, right? So we are enjoying the benefit of 2 years after the beginning of the pandemic, because I recall that the point that Dick just made about the deadliness of just regular old influenza, when people were saying that in 2020, In fact, even Donald Trump himself was saying that. There were lots of politicians and other leaders, Democratic leaders, people saying, you can't say that now. That's going to lead to that's not taking this problem seriously. So just your thoughts on that and how much has changed.
Well, yeah, I think that Robert J. Lifton's point years ago in a book about Hiroshima is so key. Psychic numbing. In order to live in the world, this terrible world, we just have to numb our psyches as a defense mechanism. And I think there was a lot of that with this pandemic. And yeah, the complacency about, well, look at how many deaths we accept every year from the flu, rather than the question of what is wrong with the public health system that can accept that sort of outcome? What's wrong with the communications? Why can't the word get out? And I think that that there was just a kind of numbing in the face of the past and of our record with controlling the social, surround of disease. And numbing about the depth and the virulence of what we were facing. And there's a point that we're going to quote later on from Andy Slavitt, but I think it's a crucial one. We sort of also just let each other down. People didn't wear masks who should have done if they understood their obligations to other people, that our poverty of social capital and of sort of minimal public fraternity had so broken down and is so broken down still that people are not taking responsibility for others.
Mm. Now, Jack and Dick, if I may, I do actually just want to focus for a few more minutes on that first year of the pandemic, because the Trump administration was in charge. And I take your point, Richard, about it being perhaps the least interesting but most important lesson. But let's talk about it a little bit more again when we're trying to weigh how and when it should listen and use to science, how science must adjust to politics. We have to talk about the specificity of politics in the United States right now. So I just want to play a couple of examples. So first of all, this is from February 26th, 2020, a press conference at the White House, and a back and forth between then-President Trump and CNN's Sanjay Gupta.
Flu has a fatality ratio of about 0.1%.
Correct.
This has a fatality ratio somewhere between 2-3%. Given that,
we don't know exactly.
Based on the numbers so far.
And the flu is higher than that. The flu is much higher than that.
There's more people who get the flu, but this is spreading, or it's going to spread maybe within communities. That's the expectation. Does that worry you? Because that seems to be what worries the American
people. No, because we're ready for it.
Okay, so that's February 26, 2020. And the reason why I wanted to play that is that Donald Trump, we found out much later, actually knew much more about the seriousness of COVID than he asserted on February 26 when he said he's not worried, the flu is worse. He questioned Gupta's quoting of the fatality rate about flu versus COVID. He basically was saying, don't worry. But then later on, Bob Woodward released tapes that he recorded on February 7th with Donald Trump. And here's what Trump said on February 7th.
It goes through air, Bob. That's always tougher than the touch. You know, the touch, you don't have to touch things, right? But the air, you just breathe the air. That's how it's passed. And so that's a very tricky one. That's a very delicate one. It's also more deadly than your strenuous flus. You know, people don't realize we lose 25,000, 30,000 people a year here. Who would ever think that, right?
I know. It's
it's pretty
forgotten.
Amazing.
And then I said, well, is that the same thing?
This is more deadly. This is 5% versus 1% and less than 1%. You know, so this is deadly stuff.
So that was from February 7th, 2020, in a phone conversation between then-President Trump and Bob Woodward. Again, February 7th. But Woodward didn't release it until September, when his book Rage went to print. So, Dick Toefel, I would like to lean on your ProPublica history here, because if we're talking about science adjusting to politics, what is the role of the media here in trying to help people understand where when politics is subsuming science? I mean, Woodward knew in February that Trump wasn't telling the truth. The American people deserve to know, but he didn't tell them until September. I mean, help me understand that.
Well, excuse me. This is, you know, this is an old issue of what do we do about book writers, and do they are they obligated to give away the key learning of their book before they can capitalize on it? Yes, it certainly might have been better if the American people had known the president was lying in February, although to me the very important point is they were told before they cast their votes, and I think that's the most important point. I also think that Dr. Gupta was getting the better of that debate both in late February and throughout the spring. The majority of the American people, the overwhelming majority of the American people, understood very quickly that this was much more serious than the flu, and you can see it in their behavior.
Mm. Well, Dick Toefel and Jack Beattie, stand by. Lots more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Jack Beattie's with us today. He's On Point's news analyst, and so is Richard Toefel. He's founding general manager and former president of ProPublica, distinguished visiting fellow at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and has recently written an article in The Atlantic titled, How is America Still This Bad at Talking About the Pandemic? And Dick Toefel, I just can't quite let it go, so forgive me. Just another couple of questions here about early leadership decisions in the Trump administration and the media's role here. Because, I mean, if we're talking about how bad we are at talking about the pandemic, we have to scrutinize the media more. And I'm stuck on what you said when you said, it, you know, we can have the debate about Woodward waiting until his book came out, but the truth is most of the American people knew. Shouldn't we be much more honest about the fact that what's in the best interest of the media was not necessarily in the best interest of the American people at the time? Because I would argue it would have made a big difference if Bob Woodward had come out and said, actually, the president knows a lot more than he is saying, don't you think?
I honestly don't think. I mean, I think the press coverage in the spring of 2020, the late winter and spring, was generally quite strong, informing the American people about an enormous range of facts that they had not needed to know and didn't understand and came to know very quickly. And the press was quite oppositional to the president when they needed to be. The president thought he could hold daily briefings and sort of turn the narrative, but with his bare hands. And he stopped doing that, as you'll recall, fairly quickly because it simply wasn't working in the face of persistent, aggressive questioning.
Mm. Jack, though, I keep thinking about all the people who especially, in a pandemic, scientifically we know in a pandemic, and this is why China locked down, why Italy locked down. If you can get early on things under control, you help you sort of hopefully usher a way to a better outcome. But early on, quote unquote, here in the United States, there were millions of people who listened to the president in those very same press conferences that Dick is rightly pointing out, who believed every word he said, right? Who didn't want to wear masks, who believed that COVID was less of a threat, et cetera, et cetera. So I guess I just respectfully disagree with Dick that the press didn't do enough to say what we know, what we don't know, and what the president knew and didn't know.
Some of it was we didn't know quite what was happening behind the scenes. I mean, in March 2020, which was the key month, the bureaucracy presented President Trump with a plan to send five or six masks to every American. He objected to it. Why? Because of his infantile, narcissistic dispute with Jeff Bezos. It would make a lot of money for Amazon. He didn't want that. People around him, notably Stephen Miller, according to the reporting, said, no, we don't want to be pushing masks. We want to polarize among masks. We want to make it a culture war issue. And then someone else said, and our base would never accept masks. Well, a couple of months later, Tony Fabrizio, their pollster, Trump's pollster, came to him and presented evidence that 70% of Republicans were fine with masks, that their hypothesis that the base wouldn't accept it, that was just wrong. And by then, Trump said, no, we're going to polarize. That was not just, in other words, he knew he had an alternative that could have saved hundreds of thousands of lives. And because of who he was, he couldn't act on it. I mean, that's a lethal failure of leadership. And the press didn't know that he knew that much at that time. This only came out later.
Yeah. So point well taken. But I also wonder if we in the media, I mean, again, we're talking about how to talk about a pandemic. If we could have asked better questions early on. And Dick, just so you know, I'm not going to endlessly beat up on Bob Woodward here. I actually, just forgive me for a moment, but I want to turn the camera back onto ourselves right here at On Point, because I've been thinking a lot ever since I read your article about our 2 years of coverage about this topic. There was a period where we did 100 straight shows on COVID in 2020. In fact, our first one was on January 29th. 2020. It was a month and a half before the global pandemic declaration. But I do want to just scrutinize what we did even back then, because at that time, China had already put Wuhan and Hubei province on lockdown, 11 million people the week before we did this particular show. And on January 29th, 2020, Dr. Anthony Fauci came on the show that day, and he noted that at that time, there was no evidence of human-to-human transmission that the CDC could find. So that day, I asked Dr. Fauci this. We have seen a ballooning very quickly of the number of cases over the past several days, right? I mean, right. I think it was just yesterday in China, it was roughly 4,500. Then this morning, it jumped to around 6,000. That's a 25% increase overnight. Can you explain why that is? Is it the disease actually spreading fast, or are we finding more cases?
You know, it's a combination of both. I mean, what it is clearly it is spreading fast. What we're seeing now is
so, Dick, the reason why I wanted to play that is because of the question that I did not ask Fauci. I wasn't skeptical enough. He had said, so far there's no evidence of human-to-human contact, but I had noted that Hubei province was locked down. I should have asked him, well, then can you help us understand why China is locking down in late January? Something must be going on, but I didn't. So really, honestly, tell me, should we, as the media, the self-appointed arbiters of seeking out truth as we know it at the time, should we have been more skeptical of a lot of things that were being said or pushed more?
So this is, I think, now we're getting to the heart of the matter, Meghna. And to me, the first lesson, and literally the first one in the article, mm-hmm. is that we need to be more accepting of ambiguity and uncertainty. There is this need for certainty, which runs very deep in people, and we all understand why. But particularly with a previously unknown pathogen, I think the principal thing that we all need to learn is that the answer at the beginning should have been a lot of, on the one hand, on the other hand, and a lot of, I don't know, because they didn't know. And so you end up with, for instance, this juxtaposition. Everybody remembers we were told to wipe down everything, don't touch anything. And that was, as you know, based on previous pathogens where that was a reasonable hypothesis that they might transmit that way. And so in an excess of caution, tell everybody to do that. Turns out not to have really been necessary at all. On the other hand, and we were talking about masks earlier, you and Jack were talking about masks, we were told actually until April officially by the government not to wear masks. Why? Well, they said they weren't necessary, but what they actually knew was we don't have enough masks. Mm-hmm. And they believed that if they told people, if you use the surgical masks, the hospitals will collapse because they desperately need them and we don't have enough, that people wouldn't pay attention to that. And that in retrospect, the right message would have been, for the same in an excess of caution, everyone should put on a mask and they should put on a bandana, preferably, or a scarf, because they should leave the surgical masks, which were most of the masks we had at that time, to the medical professionals.
Yeah. So, Dick, let me just jump in here because I completely agree with you. I mean, in a sense, if I could go back and redo all our coverage, I would start every single show of On Point with, here's what we know today, here's what we don't know. Here's what we're trying to figure out about the pandemic, and just ask those questions over and over and over again to every person who came on the program. But to the point about masks in particular, I mean, there was a moment where what you just said, Dr. Fauci himself tried to get that message out, like, don't wear masks because we don't have enough of them. But because of our broken politics, the second half of that message got lost in the maelstrom. So I just want to play. This is from March of 2020 when Anthony Fauci was talking with Jonathan LaPook on CBS's 60 Minutes.
People should not be walking around with masks.
You're sure of it? Because people are listening really closely to this.
Right now, people should not be walking. There's no reason to be walking around with a mask. When you're in the middle of an outbreak, wearing a mask might make people feel a little bit better, and it might even block a droplet, but it's not providing the perfect protection that people think that it is. And often, there are unintended consequences. People keep fiddling with the mask, and they keep touching their face.
And can you get some schmutz sort of staying inside there?
Of course. But when you think masks, you should think of healthcare providers needing them and people who are ill. The people who, when you look at the films of foreign countries and you see 85% of the people wearing masks, that's fine. That's fine. I'm not against it. If you want to do it, that's fine.
But it can lead to a shortage of masks.
Exactly. That's the point. It could lead to a shortage of masks for the people who really need it.
Dick Toefel, is that Fauci sort of embracing ambiguity or kind of losing what his real message should have been at the time?
I think it's an insufficient willingness, honestly, to level with the American people. It is the second part of what he said is absolutely true. The first part is absolutely not. And what they really concluded, and we made this mistake over and over again, is if we tell people things on the one hand, on the other hand, they can't handle it. And I think actually what we've learned is we should do that. And in part, we should do it because they learn, one of the most important things they learn is, are you telling them the truth? Mm-hmm. You know, I have enormous respect for Dr. Fauci, and he has done great public service, not just for decades, but in this, in particular in 2020, enormous public service. But people in March should have been wearing masks, and they should have been wearing bandanas, not surgical masks. And if they'd been told that, they might have learned over time, the government is leveling with me even when it's hard.
You know, Jack, let me turn back to you here because earlier in the week, you and I and the staff discussed how some of the exact kind of clear communication around uncertainty was happening at the level of governors, right? And their sort of daily press briefing to the people of their state. So I want to note that here. But, you know, Dick is very right that leveling with the American people, being honest about ambiguity and uncertainty is really the only way to get through a crisis where information is changing every day. But don't we run up against the problem that for so long in this country, kind of mass communication has always gone through a political filter, and the filter of politics, you know, sorts for certainty and guarantees and lack of ambiguity, whether it's right or wrong, over uncertainty.
Yes, an incessant repetition of same, you know, just the you know, I'm for this, they're for that, the psychology and the politics of polarization. And of course, the pandemic, tragically for so many Americans, fell into just that binary, with Trump polarizing on masks and even on vaccines. I mean, being the great triumph of his administration, he didn't quite embrace it. And then, of course, after the election, when you know, Delta was rampant, he just sort of pulled out of everything. Didn't do, you know, went on vacation and nursed his grievances. And so all that really, really hurt. And all the nuanced communication in the world could not possibly overcome the polarization and the binary of I'm going to make this a political issue, and no matter what happens, I don't care about ambiguity. I just want to win.
Mm. Now, Dick Toeffel, we've got 2 minutes left here, so I'm really eager to hear from you about, you know, these lessons that you've gleaned. How can we create a system in which the lessons can be learned and then acted upon? When the next, you know, major crisis, a public health crisis, comes along, what needs to happen so that political leadership is willing to embrace ambiguity and communicate that ambiguity, and that also there's a better adjustment, as we talked earlier, between science and politics?
Yeah, I mean, this is the key question. I think, Meghna, that the key thing is to... It is a good time now, and for as long as we have, and you know, if we have a few years, to think quite deeply about this. I think, for instance, we need to, and they are starting to think about this on Capitol Hill, we need to reorganize the elements of the government that deal with pandemics. We need a lot of us to reflect in this kind of way about the lessons, but some of it is we just need not to forget. You know, the very end of John Barry's wonderful book about the 1918 flu, the last two or three pages, and it's a book that George W. Bush picked up and really valued while he was president and did a lot of the pandemic preparedness that had been done before this. It ends with that the most important thing is to tell the American people the truth. And I actually think that lesson of 1918 is the same lesson of 2020 to 2022. So that's the one, if I had only one, that I would spend time thinking about.
Jack, we have 30 seconds left. Do you have confidence that American politics, culture, and society as it is right now can get us to that place?
In a word, no. One study in 2021 had our country rated as the lowest possible score in public trust in government. And since government is public health is under government, that applies to the pronouncements of people like Dr. Fauci, tragically.
Mm. Well, truth and trust. We're going to come back to these things over and over and over again. Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And Dick Toeffel, founding general manager of ProPublica, and his article in The Atlantic, we've got a link to it at onpointradio.org. Dick, thank you so very much for coming on the show.
Meghna, thank you so much for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.